Today is Monday, October 4th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedo for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, pressure mounts on President Biden as infrastructure bill stalls in Congress.
I'm telling you, we're going to get this done. It doesn't matter when.
Plus, EU says the Taliban's policy is, quote, not very encouraging, unquote.
We don't want to support this government depending on their behavior. And their behavior, until now, is not very encouraging.
Also, leaked documents expose a, quote, Pandora box, unquote, where hundreds of world leaders hide their investments. Our top story today is in the U.S. U.S. President Joe Biden sets out this week to promote his domestic agenda. The president's Democratic Party is at odds with itself over two bills, a $1.2 trillion infrastructure package and a $3.5 trillion social spending bill. Michelle Cohen reports.
President Biden is under pressure this week to bring together two sides of his Democratic Party over the two massive spending bills that are linked and key to his domestic agenda.
I'm telling you, we're going to get this done. It doesn't matter when. It doesn't matter whether it's in 6 minutes, 6 days, or 6 weeks. We're going to get it done.
With bipartisan support, the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill for roads, bridges, and highways has passed the Senate. But in the House of Representatives, progressives in the Democratic Party say they won't approve that infrastructure bill until their party reaches a deal on the larger $3.5 trillion social spending package that includes money for initiatives such as the environment, education, and child care. Speaker Nancy Pelosi delayed the House vote on the infrastructure bill, angering some moderates. In a statement, Senator Kyrsten Sinema, a moderate Democrat from Arizona, called the delay inexcusable and a stunt to hold the infrastructure bill hostage to the larger measure. Republicans oppose the bigger spending plan, with Senator John Barrasso, a Republican from Wyoming, calling it this big government socialism reckless bill on Fox News Sunday. The Democrats, with a slim margin in the House and an evenly divided Senate, where Vice President Kamala Harris is needed to tip the balance in case of a tie, need to unite their party if they want to get the larger package passed. Senator Bernie Sanders is an independent from Vermont. He spoke on ABC's this week.
Both of these bills are going forward in tandem. We've got to pass them both.
The House is out of session for the next 2 weeks. President Biden reportedly told Democrats that the bill's price tag will likely need to come down to $2.1 trillion. And some progressive Democrats say a potential compromise could include shortening the period the bill will fund. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said on Sunday the goal will be to get both an infrastructure bill and a multi-trillion-dollar social spending bill passed in the next month, overcoming divisions between moderates and progressive Democrats. President Joe Biden visited the Capitol on Friday to try to end a fight between moderates and progressives in his Democratic Party that has threatened the two bills that make up the core of his domestic agenda, a fiscal infrastructure bill and a multi-trillion-dollar social spending bill, what Biden has dubbed, quote, human infrastructure, unquote. Leading Democrats have described the bill as the most ambitious legislation since President Franklin Roosevelt pushed through his New Deal of the 1930s, which sought to help Americans struggling during the Great Depression with huge government-led infrastructure projects.
We're trying to pass some of the most dramatic, significant legislation to help working families throughout New York and throughout the country that's been done since Franklin D. Roosevelt. It takes a little time. I believe we're on track with both tracks to pass both the bipartisan infrastructure bill as well as the reconciliation Build Back Better bill. And our goal is to get it done in the next month, both bills, and get them passed. I have always said from the get-go, we need to do both, and we need everyone. We need unity in both our caucuses in the House and Senate to get both done. If we get them done in the next 30 days, I think it'll be a very great help to everybody in the country, let alone the caucuses.
That's U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. There's a new weapon against COVID-19, and it's in capsule form. VOA's Caroline Pursucci explains how its breakthrough and why other pills have been discovered that we haven't heard about.
A stark illustration of the new number of COVID deaths in the United States, 700,000. From the White House.
That is a striking, horrifying number of lives lost.
But now, new hope. A pill that drug company Merck says prevents the coronavirus from multiplying. So promising that the clinical trials were stopped early so more lives could be saved. Taken at the onset of the disease, the pill reduces the risk of hospitalization or death by half.
They could go to their pharmacy and take their medication the way they do other medicines. This would allow us to treat many more people much more quickly, and we trust much less expensively.
Dr. Caleb Hernandez is an emergency room doctor who also researches COVID drug discoveries. He says three other pills have been introduced, one that reduces the need for oxygen by threefold, but not under big pharmaceutical names. So they sit on a shelf without the money for FDA approval.
Our government isn't set up to spend the $500,000 to do these studies. We rely on private companies to bring things to the FDA. And that's why you're not going to see as much innovation as you could see.
Experts worry that Americans will rely more on this new pill and avoid vaccines that teach the body to make its own coronavirus antibodies. But for remote countries, pills may be easier to administer. Affordability and distribution are other factors, though. Hernandez hopes that some drug, any drug, will end the pandemic.
But all I can think about is seeing that look on your face.
He sings this tribute to a fellow doctor who quit the profession because he was burned out from COVID.
We've been going for almost 2 years now, fighting every day, watching people die. And I think it's difficult when people in the community don't believe you. They think that you're part of some conspiracy or you're exaggerating or making things up. And then you go to work and you have to pronounce multiple people dead.
Merck plans to seek approval for emergency use of the drug, which could take about 2 months. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
Australia has officially become the world's most locked down city since the pandemic began. Residents have endured 245 days of stay-at-home orders, surpassing Buenos Aires, Argentina. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Melbourne, the Victoria state capital, is now in its sixth COVID-19 lockdown. This one began more than 80 days ago on August 5. To date, the longest shutdown lasted for 111 days, between July and October last year. Stay-at-home orders were first issued in Australia's second biggest city in late March 2020 to curb the spread of infections. Many businesses have been forced to close, while millions of people have had to work and study from home, and nighttime curfews have also been imposed. Opposition politicians in Victoria have sharply criticised the state government over the length and intensity of the lockdowns. But the authorities have insisted they had no choice but to repeatedly take drastic action because of the slow initial pace of Australia's national vaccination rollout, due in part to supply problems. The state's chief health officer, Brett Sutton, says the tough measures have saved lives.
I mean, it's been an awful crisis for the world, for Melbourne, more than any other place in Australia. We have to face the crisis that's in front of us. It's a reality that we are lagging amongst OECD countries for the vaccination rollout. That is the vulnerability that means that you have to have a lockdown to manage potentially catastrophic numbers and catastrophic numbers of deaths.
1,377 new locally acquired coronavirus cases and 4 fatalities were recorded in Victoria Monday. But even as Delta variant infections continue to surge, authorities are pressing ahead with plans to lift lockdown restrictions on October 26, when 70% of the population is fully vaccinated. The current inoculation rate is about 54%. Canberra and other parts of eastern Australia remain in lockdown. Sydney has had more than 100 days of stay-at-home orders since restrictions were imposed in late June. Its lockdown is expected to be lifted on October 11, when vaccination levels reach 70%. Australia has recorded 111,000 COVID-19 cases since the pandemic began. 1,300 people have died. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The European Union foreign policy chief said on Sunday the Taliban's government's behaviour up to now was not, quote, very encouraging, unquote, and any economic collapse in Afghanistan will raise the risk of terrorism and other threats. Josep Borrell, speaking at a news conference with his Saudi Arabian counterpart, also said he hoped nuclear talks between global powers and Iran will restart in Vienna soon. The EU diplomat who is in Riyadh following visits to Qatar and the United Arab Emirates said he briefed his partners on the prospects of restarting nuclear talks and exchanged views with Saudi officials on Yemen and Afghanistan. The EU has increased its humanitarian aid to Afghanistan since the Taliban took power, but halted development assistance, a move also taken by other countries and World Bank.
Certainly, it is a dilemma, because if you want to contribute to avoid the collapse of the economy, in a certain way, you can consider supporting the government. And this is not the case. We don't want to support this government, depending on their behavior. And their behavior, until now, is not very encouraging. The European Union announced from the beginning that we were going to increase our humanitarian support to the Afghan people, multiplying by four, from 50 to 200 our support. We are already doing that. The first planes with humanitarian help has already landed in Kabul, and I have to say that the distribution of this humanitarian help has been forming well without any kind of interference.
That's European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. Taliban forces have raided an Islamic State affiliate hideout in the Afghan capital and killed several insurgents hours after a bombing outside a mosque. Suspicion for that deadly attack quickly fell on the Islamic State group, which has ramped up attacks against its Taliban enemy. The Taliban statement did not say how many insurgents were killed in the raid. Sunday's bombing was the deadliest attack since the Taliban took control of Afghanistan with the chaotic departure of the last U.S. troops. North Korea Monday restored severed inter-Korean hotlines but urged South Korea to step up efforts to improve relations, state media KCNA reported. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
North Korea restored the severed hotlines with the South on Monday, but it also urged Seoul to step up efforts to improve relations. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un opened the possibility of reactivating the hotlines last week. They had been severed since early August when Pyongyang cut them off in protest against joint U.S.-South Korea military drills. Kim also urged Seoul and Washington to drop their, quote, double standards over weapons development, and accused the U.S. of keeping up its hostile policy while also proposing denuclearization talks. North Korea has fired a series of projectiles in recent weeks, including a never-before-seen hypersonic missile and an anti-aircraft missile. Pyongyang maintains that these tests are meant to improve its self-defense just as others do. The launches highlight the isolated country's ongoing development of increasingly sophisticated weapons as denuclearization talks with the U.S. have stalled. The Biden administration has said it has no hostile intent towards North Korea and has called on Pyongyang to resume talks.
That's Gloria So of Reuters. North Korea said on Sunday the United Nations Security Council applied double standards over military activities among U.N. member states, state media KCNA said. The statement comes amid international criticism over its recent missile tests. Edward Buran of Reuters reports.
It comes amid international criticism over its recent missile tests. The Council met behind closed doors on Friday upon request from the United States and other countries over the North's missile launches. The meeting came a day after Pyongyang fired a newly developed anti-aircraft missile, the latest in a series of weapons tests. They include the launches of a previously unseen hypersonic missile, ballistic missiles, and a cruise missile with potential nuclear capabilities. The North Korean Foreign Ministry's Department of International Organizations said the Security Council meeting means an encroachment on its sovereignty. It accused the Council of double standards as it remains silent about U.S. joint military exercises and weapons tests with allies. North Korea warned the council could face consequences if it continues to breach the North's sovereignty, quote, with the double dealing stick. Pyongyang said in recent weeks that its weapons tests are aimed at boosting its defense capabilities.
That's Edwin Baran of Reuters. Fumio Kishida has been elected Japan's prime minister in a parliamentary vote and will be tasked with quickly tackling the pandemic and other challenges and leading a national election within weeks. Kishida won comfortably since his party and his coalition partner hold a majority in both houses. Kishida used to be known as a moderate, but turned hawkish on security and more conservative on gender equality and other issues with the apparent aim to win the support of influential conservatives in his party. Predecessor Yoshihide Suga resigned only 1 year in office as his support plunged over the pandemic. This is the Voice of America. Jordan's King Abdullah II has denied any propriety in his purchase of luxury homes abroad, citing security needs for keeping the transactions quiet and saying no public funds were used. Monday's comment by the Royal Palace comes a day after an international consortium of investigative journalists reported that the monarch has secretly bought more than $106 million in luxury homes over the past decade by using offshore transactions. The more than 330 current and former politicians identified as beneficiaries of the secret accounts include Jordan's King Abdullah II, former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair, Czech Republic Prime Minister Andrej Babiš, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, Ecuador's President Guillermo Lasso, and associates of both Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan and Russian President Vladimir Putin. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet is calling on Bangladesh authorities to conduct a prompt and thorough investigation into the murder of Rohingya activist Mohid Ullah while he was visiting a Cox's Bazar refugee camp in Bangladesh earlier this week. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet paid tribute to the prominent human rights defender, who she said spent his life fighting to end decades of discrimination against the Rohingya people. She said Mohib Ullah lost his life while seeking to restore his people's basic rights in Myanmar, including their rights to nationality, land, health, and education. Ullah was shot and killed by unknown assailants Wednesday in Kutupalong, the world's largest refugee camp, housing more than 800,000 Rohingya. The refugees fled there in August of 2017 to escape persecution and violence in Myanmar. The High Commissioner's spokesman, Rupert Colville, says the Rohingya are still waiting for justice and still waiting to return home. He says there has been an alarming increase in violence, criminality, and rising tensions among groups in the Kutupalong camp. He adds anti-Rohingya sentiment also has been rising within Bangladeshi communities.
Whoever was responsible for his murder, Mohib Ullah's death is a clear example of the insecurity in the camp and the apparent attempts to silence moderate civil society voices. The High Commissioner is calling for a prompt, thorough, and independent investigation, which should be conducted not only to identify and apprehend his killers and expose their motives, but also to define what measures are needed to better protect vulnerable civil society leaders while avoiding further securitization in the camps.
Colville says the High Commissioner understands the huge challenges Bangladesh faces in hosting Rohingya refugees. Nonetheless, Bachelet asserts Bangladesh must ensure the safety, protection, and basic rights of the refugees in Cox's Bazar. She says that also applies to Basanchar, a remote island where thousands of Rohingya have been relocated.
Meanwhile, in Myanmar itself, the situation of approximately 600,000 Rohingya who remain in Rakhine State remains dire, with many still confined in camps. Alleged violations include unlawful killings, arbitrary arrest and detention, and high levels of extortion.
Colville says it is regrettable the global spotlight has moved away from the plight of the Rohingya people. He says the High Commissioner is calling on the international community to do more to help the persecuted community, both in Bangladesh and in Myanmar. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Tensions have heightened between Algeria and France in response to comments by French President Emmanuel Macron that Algeria says were an inadmissible interference in its affairs. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Tensions have heightened between Algeria and France in response to comments by French President Emmanuel Macron, which Algeria are calling inadmissible. The North African nation has refused permission for France to fly military planes in its airspace and announced the recall of its ambassador from Paris. The sharp escalations in tensions comes after Macron accused Algerian authorities of stoking hatred for France. The comments were made at a meeting with the grandchildren of French and Algerian fighters in Algeria's war of independence from France. France has also announced the decision to slash the number of visas issued to people in North Africa because governments there are refusing to take back migrants expelled from France. I'm Karen Chamas.
Greece has agreed to buy 3 state-of-the-art warships from France, boosting its military capabilities after a decade-long economic recession that cut its defense spending by nearly half. The deal boosts Greece's military capabilities, but critics fear it may stoke further tensions between Greece and its neighbor Turkey, both NATO members. And Thea Karasava explains from Athens.
The $5 billion deal will provide Athens with 3 Belhara frigates and 3 Gowind corvettes, with an option for 1 more of each. Officials say the first vessels will be delivered as early as 2024, with the remainder shipped to Greece 2 years later. Vice Admiral Stelios Fenekos explains the importance of the French frigates. He says these are state-of-the-art ships that provide support for a whole host of activities, from minding submarines and drones to firing missiles. The frigates have the capability to oversee 800 key locations and act and react swiftly. With their addition to the Greek Navy, the entire stretch of the country's water frontiers, from the northern tip of the Aegean to as far south as Cyprus, will be shielded closely, Fenekos says. The deal complements another lucrative agreement Greece announced last year to buy at least 18 fourth-generation Rafale fighter jets for $2.5 billion. These defense contracts have helped seal a strategic defense strategy between Greece and France. The Turkish government, for its part, says the deal violates international law. For Ankara, which has been at odds with Athens for years over the Aegean waterway that divides the two countries and the Eastern Mediterranean, the latest arms purchase is a game changer at its expense. George Filis, a professor of geopolitics in Athens, explains.
Το υλικό αυτό θα φέρει το ελληνικό πολεμικό ναυτικό 10-15 χρόνια μπροστά από τους Τούρκους.
The deals advance Greece's military capability significantly, putting them 10 to 15 years ahead of Turkey. And with Turkey facing arms embargoes from countries like the United States, the prospect of boosting its capabilities is limited. Turkey, Filis says, is clearly in a bind. Greece and Turkey have been at odds over air and sea rights in the Aegean for ages. Last year, the two countries came to the brink of war over competing claims to drilling rights in the eastern Mediterranean. France sided with Greece's rights, sending warships to the region to challenge Turkey in a move that enraged President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Under the new deal, France will come to Greece's military aid if requested and under threat. Likewise, Greece will aid France in military operations in sub-Saharan territories France has vested interests in. With tensions brewing anew between Greece and Turkey, Filis says he fears the latest deal may only aggravate tense relations.
Σε κάθε περίπτωση είναι game changer όλη αυτή η διαδικασία.
There is no doubt that this deal is a major game changer in the region, and Turkey may move to test the limits and reflexes of this new strategic alliance, he says. There has to be vigilance, he warns. Greece's parliament votes on the agreement on Tuesday. Anthi Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.